This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals on the web at putnam.com/529. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Interesting day today. Two big economic speeches on the calendar, one by a guy who can change things, the other by a guy who maybe can't. The president and the chairman of the Fed were the two, but which one is which? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering Pop Money, a way to pay other people online by sending an email or text. Learn more at allybank.com. And by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Thursday, today the 8th of September. Good, as always, to have you with us. In a week heavy with news of jobs and the economy, this is, you could fairly say, the political day. There's the president's speech tonight, of course, and the Fed chairman's speech this afternoon was about as pointed as you're ever going to hear a central banker get. So as we continue with the breakdown, our economy one step at a time, what political Washington has to say about a key economic problem. This evening, the president's going to ask Congress to approve an emergency program of tax cuts and government spending aimed at creating jobs just as fast as possible. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale starts our coverage.
Obama's roughly $300 billion plan is his second try at stimulating the economy. Back in 2009, he spent nearly $800 billion. This time, the tax cuts and spending are more targeted. For example, extending benefits for the unemployed. Princeton professor Betsy Stevenson says every dollar given to jobless workers generates $2 of economic activity.
You give someone who's unemployed a dollar, they go out and buy some groceries with that dollar. And the money that's paid to the grocer with that dollar then gets used to pay wages to their worker. That worker goes out and purchases perhaps gas. It's that on and on and on as that dollar moves through the economy that generates the $2 in economic activity.
Another significant part of the plan will extend a payroll tax cut for workers and give a new one to employers who hire. But Bruce Bartlett, a former economic advisor to Republican presidents, says those tax cuts are likely to be saved, not spent.
The payroll tax cut goes only to people who have jobs, who by and large are doing pretty well as compared to the unemployed. So I think you're getting very little bang for the buck there.
The president will also propose funding more infrastructure projects that offer longer-term financial benefits for transportation and education. And finally, there'll be significant aid to local governments to keep teachers and police on the payroll. Bartlett says they're being laid off by the hundreds of thousands.
The main impact there will not be so much to create new jobs as to prevent jobs from disappearing.
Will $300 billion in spending and tax breaks be enough? Betsy Stevenson would like to see more, but she figures that's all the president can get.
He's not someone who's going to go up there and talk pie in the sky on something that no Republican would ever agree to. I expect to see something that will be extraordinarily bipartisan. I don't think we can do more in the current climate.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Ben Bernanke went to Minneapolis today for his speech. It was yet another chance for economists and investors and business journalists to read the tea leaves and get a sense of what the Fed chairman's thinking. Because of the two, the president and Ben Bernanke, Bernanke's the guy who's going to have an easier time actually getting something done. Marketplace's David Gurra reports.
When the Fed chairman speaks, there's no shortage of scintillating sound bites.
In addition to refining our forward guidance, the Federal Reserve has a range of tools that could be used to provide additional monetary stimulus.
That's Ben Bernanke all but saying the Fed could intervene in the economy some more. Economists say the Federal Reserve might do something more radical to get money circulating. Economist Kevin Jakes teaches at Baldwin-Wallace College.
The Federal Reserve would start to buy more and more long-term bonds, 10, 20, 30-year bonds.
And it would start to sell off short-term bonds.
What that would do is drive bond prices up and push those interest rates down.
Below the really, really low rates we have right now. Dean Mackey is chief U.S. economist at Barclays Capital. He says then investors might move into stocks.
Presumably that will push them either to go out into riskier assets or to spend that money.
The Federal Reserve's got a second option. It could cut the interest it pays banks on the trillions of dollars they stash at the Fed. It's at 0.25%. And Kevin Jakes says right now, that's a pretty good return.
If I am a bank and I have reason to believe I may need liquidity, and the central bank, the Federal Reserve, is paying me to keep the money as opposed to lending it out, then I have a financial incentive to keep more money than I otherwise would.
Without that incentive, banks would have to look for something else to do with all that money. They might just start lending it to businesses and folks like you and me. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
It's oh so easy to sit on the political sidelines and throw stones at the Fed or at the president. As you can imagine, Republican presidential candidates pretty much have that wired. Last night at a debate in California, they test drove their ideas to great jobs, most of which can be filed under the letter G. Forget the government out of the way. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
It's clear the preferred strategy for a GOP candidate is to quote Ronald Reagan. So it's a bit odd when conservative economist Richard Vedder at Ohio University talks up
Warren G. Harding, who absolutely did nothing. He drank a lot, played a lot of golf. Rumors had it he had quite a few girlfriends.
And we won't even touch that Teapot Dome stuff.
But he let markets work.
His point is, even Harding created growth and jobs by scooting the government out of the way of business. That's the mantra. Here's Texas Governor Rick Perry last night.
And we're going to lower the regulation impact on you and free them to do what they do best, create jobs.
He said government spending creates no jobs, which earns a split verdict from Wharton economist Justin Wolfers, now visiting at Princeton. Sure, he says, almost every economist agrees the government should balance its books.
But the idea that in the midst of near-record unemployment, that what we should do is cut back on government spending and fire more teachers and policemen is completely absurd. Never in my life have I seen a greater disjunction between the standard approach to economics and political discourse.
Another Republican job idea? Fossil fuel extraction. Oil, gas, coal. Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney.
We can become energy secure, and we can create jobs right here in the United States by developing our own energy resources.
That is, if Romney gets to handcuff environmental regulators. MIT economist Michael Greenstone agrees clean air rules have hurt polluting companies. He counts 600,000 job losses. But
they were also effective at reducing air pollution, decreasing infant mortality rates, and even increasing home prices.
Another question about energy is how much of a job engine it really is, with machines replacing people. So there are costs and benefits. It's case by case. It's that professorly nuance that may not travel well in a campaign. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The president speaks, by the way, tonight at 7 p.m. Washington time. The White House promises he'll be done in time for the Packers-Saints kickoff. Wall Street was doing all right today until traders turned their TVs to that Bernanke speech, and then it kissed 100 points goodbye, just like that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Most of the new jobs in this economy come from small and medium-sized businesses. The official number, courtesy of the Small Business Administration, is about 64% of net new jobs over the past 15 years have come from small businesses. Only right now, they're not creating any jobs. Nobody is, really, which is why we're getting all these plans from President Obama and GOP candidates and the Chamber of Commerce and everybody else. There are, though, some smaller companies that have more business now than they did when the recession began. We sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman out from the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting to find a company that's hiring.
Oregon City is a working-class town with a smattering of industrial parks full of small to mid-sized manufacturers. Many have struggled to stay afloat, not Benchmade Knife Company, though.
Over here we go to our machining area.
Founder and co-owner Les Diasis says people who visit the factory are often surprised knife making can be so clean.
So they expect anvils and sparks and dirt and grime. And what we have here is essentially a very modern computer-controlled manufacturing environment.
We step into Diasis's office and I ask, in this economy, who's buying Benchmade's products, essentially decked-out pocket knives, at hundreds to more than $1,000 a pop?
We sell a market of traditional hunters, sportsmen, first responders, medical, military.
What do soldiers use the knives for?
A simple tool for a hunter when he's out in the field was purchased by an army medic to free trapped soldiers or people in overturned vehicles.
Those military sales helped the company ramp up employment after 9/11. Then, going into the recession, the company downsized.
We reduced down to about 130. Today, we're about 180.
That's more than a 30% increase in workers at a time layoffs were soaring nationwide. The company's also added a machine shop off-site. Diasis says the decision to keep hiring is driven by simple mathematics. Sales have been growing by double-digit rates to around $30 million a year.
Well, we get to a point you can only get so much productivity before you suffer burnout from overtime and, the forced march. So we weigh each and every hire very carefully, but as long as the orders keep coming in, we want to fill them.
The company's also invested in the latest robotic machines to cut, grind, and polish the super-hard knife blades. Manufacturing manager Tony Koch says if you thought that would lead to layoffs as people are replaced by machines, you'd be dead wrong.
Adding automation into some of the more manual, repetitive tasks frees up those people to move on to some of the higher skilled, less repetitive activities, and then focus on additional product to provide us a growth opportunity.
Economist Bernard Baumol says an important growth opportunity for mid-sized firms is to cultivate foreign business.
That would certainly accelerate job growth because the export market is one of the most vibrant in the U.S. right now.
It's certainly vibrant for Benchmade. Diasis says exports are around 5% of sales and growing.
It was like 28% increase this year over last year and about 80% between this year and 3 years ago. So our most prolific markets are going to be Russia, Eastern Europe, and China. They just rock.
America might not have the shiniest reputation right now for running an economy, but the Made in America brand still shines in the developing world. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
When you get home tonight, or right now if you're already there, take a look around for a second at everything in your house that's plugged in. Stereos, iPods and pads, televisions, computers, all of it. And then consider this. Residential electricity demand in this country actually fell the first 3 months of the year. And as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports from the Sustainability Desk, that's a problem for power companies.
Even when you adjust for the weather, power demand fell 1.3% in the first quarter of the year. That means even with all our laptops and gadgets, we used less electricity. In fact, over the last decade, electricity demand has been leveling off, and utilities don't know what to make of it exactly.
We've speculated.
Bob Powers is with Ohio-based American Electric Power.
Customers are feeling the pinch of the economy. They're feeling the pinch of high gasoline prices, and they've decided to pull back where they may.
That's one popular theory. Another?
Actually, flat panel televisions are definitely becoming more efficient than their earlier brethren.
40% more, to be exact. Energy researcher Tom Reddick says we're reaping the benefits of years of efficiency regulation. Reddick's got another theory, though. All those boomerang kids moving back in with the rents after college, relatives combining households to save on the rent.
And as a consequence, we get a net decrease in actual energy used.
Indeed, the government predicts between 2005 and 2020, home power use will have grown less than 0.25%. But analyst Larry Makovich at IHS CIRA says don't count your kilowatts just yet. Who knows what power-hungry technology is in our futures?
Electric vehicles.
That's a hint, says Makovich. But utilities would like more certainty so they can decide whether to build more power plants or not. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the consequences can be cool, but also very creepy.
Big Brother might really be watching. The economic legacy of September 11th, but first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so apparently Ben Bernanke didn't say what investors wanted to hear. The Dow Industrials dropped 119 points today, just over 1%, closed at 11,295. The Nasdaq slipped 19 points, about 0.75%, finished at 2529. The S&P 500 fell 12 points, a little more than 1%, ended at 1185. After spiking yesterday, financial stocks hit the skids again. Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase both lost 3.75%. Goldman Sachs ditched 3.25%, while Morgan Stanley coughed up an even 3%. Energy stocks ran out of gas as well. ConocoPhillips trickled down 0.2%. Chevron and ExxonMobil each drained about 1%. Restaurant reservation site OpenTable was among the day's big losers. Investors sent back more than 8% of its share price. We'll tell you why coming up in, a minute and a half or so. Bond prices rose on this Thursday. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.97%. I know I say this a lot, but 1.97 is really, really low for the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at Progressive.com. And by the American Payroll Association, thanking payroll professionals during National Payroll Week, September 5th through 9th. More at nationalpayrollweek.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the House Armed Services Committee discusses the current status of suicide prevention programs in the military. On September 9th, 1975, the sitcom Welcome Back, Cotter began airing. And organizers around the country continue preparations for events commemorating the anniversary of 9/11. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Just because it's a multi-gazillion-dollar search engine company doesn't mean Google can ignore trends, you know. And one key online trend now is local. Everybody's doing it. So today, Google took another big step in that direction. It bought the restaurant review company Zagat. Yeah, I used to call it Zagat, too. The deal lands Google smack in the middle of the local restaurant review scene occupied by the likes of Yelp and OpenTable. Sally Herships reports now on the coming food fight.
Google already lists restaurant reviews, and the company makes millions from the ads that appear alongside those search results. But Zagat goes beyond search. Colin Sebastian is an internet analyst at R.W. Baird. I caught up with him as he was heading into a meeting with Google.
I don't think this was necessary for them to continue growing their core business, but it helps them gain more of a foothold in the local market.
And more marketing dollars from local businesses. Dollars that now go to sites like OpenTable, Yelp, and Yahoo. Sebastian says buying Zagat also brings more customer reviews to Google.
And that makes Google's search results more relevant, and that makes it more useful for those local searches.
John Greening teaches marketing at Northwestern. He says Google wants to use local content to stand out.
And then that audience stays loyal to Google.
Those who stay loyal to Zagat still need to pay. $24.95 a year. Google says it has no plans to change Sagat's pricing. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We've been talking on the program this week about jobs, mostly the lack thereof. One of the complaints you hear a lot from employers is that they can't find workers with the right skills. Commentator Betsy Stevenson said the other day those companies just aren't looking hard enough. Alan Lodenslager from Denver says employers are hung up on a piece of paper.
If you ain't got the right degree or certificate, you won't get the interview. Most of those older workers learned their skills long before there was a degree or a certificate in that field, and the cost and time to get that credential is prohibitive. The problem is not employers or cost. It's caused by using the wrong HR filters.
Dr. Larry Breiterman, he's a dentist in Wayne, New Jersey, disagrees. He's been trying to hire people, he says, and it's way harder than you think.
Even among those that somewhat fit the criteria, you find that there's either large gaps in their employment history or they simply are not interested in working. You know, in my kind of business, we work some nights and weekends, and we find that a lot of people, when we tell them that there's nights and weekends involved, that they're just not interested.
We tried on Tuesday to parse the language of jobs and work, words that get used a lot, often interchangeably. The difference, says Shlomit Osiello of Rockport, Maine, is this.
Jobs provide pay and tax revenue, data for the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and talking points for political candidates. Work, at least good work, provides needed goods and services, a sense of useful occupation and dignity, and a good night's sleep at the end of a hard day. When the two come together, it's very good indeed.
Here's the obligatory segue. Tell us whether you think we're doing a good job or not. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Our coverage of the economic legacy of September 11th takes a turn to technology today and the law of unintended consequences. Not long after the attacks, the federal government began investing heavily in new technologies, technologies that Washington said would make us safer as individuals and more secure as a nation. One of them was facial recognition research. Back then, it sounded futuristic, something out of James Bond. And then Facebook happened. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
A couple of weeks ago at a conference in Las Vegas, a professor from Carnegie Mellon University named Alessandro Acquisti showed me a neat trick. He takes out his iPhone and boots up a custom-made app. It's designed to take a picture of a person, any person. Then using a facial recognition program made by PitPat, the app compares that picture to profile photos published on Facebook. And bingo, the person's identity is revealed.
Can you take my picture and see if you can identify me?
We can try.
Yeah?
60 seconds later, Acquisti's iPhone has found me. It has my real name and a picture of me sitting with my two kids on the stoop of my old house in Washington, D.C. It also has scanned the web and found a picture of me at a cocktail party in Los Angeles, holding a martini with my arm around a colleague. This picture actually got me in trouble with my mother-in-law.
The combination of these technologies is bringing us closer to a world where online and offline data merge.
And when the online and offline worlds merge,
and the consequences can be cool, but also very creepy.
The app's creepiest trick comes next. It delivers its best guess at my social security number. In my case, it gets the number wrong. But if the app can figure out where you're born from scanning your Facebook page, it has a good shot of getting that number right. So how did we end up here? Fred Kate is a law professor and privacy guru at Indiana University. He says after 9/11, two independent trends dovetailed and reinforced each other. The federal government was investing hundreds of millions in surveillance technology and research to try and keep us safer. And companies like Google and Facebook were remaking the digital landscape. There was a data-collecting revolution.
9/11 and the sort of huge growth in social networking and in profiling and collecting internet traffic, those are really parallel with each other.
And Kate says,
we have gotten more use to more surveillance. And it's not clear that that's just attributable to the events of 9/11, But particularly when you think about the types of security we go through now would have been pretty close to unthinkable a decade ago.
And some of the technologies that make this world possible only work today because of 9/11. Just take a look at facial recognition. It's one of the technologies that make Aquisti's app work. But 10 years ago, it didn't work very well at all. Michael Sipes is a vice president of PitPat.
So the intelligence community funded the early development of the technology because they had a problem. They're collecting information at a rate faster than they can process it and make use of it.
And facial recognition could help. Sipes' company spun out of a Carnegie Mellon lab that received hundreds of thousands of dollars in funding from ARPA, the intelligence community's research arm. In this industry, that same basic story plays out again and again. Professor Alan Yang helped create another powerful facial recognition program that can recognize people even when they're wearing glasses, masks, or hats that cover some of their features.
My research is funded by two grants. One is from the Army Research Office. Another one is from the Army Research Lab.
These investments after 9/11 created breakthroughs. Here's PitPat's Michael Sipes.
The technology, the face recognition technology, is just now really becoming reliable enough to be useful to a consumer.
And venture capitalists and tech giants noticed. Some of the most successful new companies in America today make their money collecting and analyzing data about us and using it to create new services or tailor ads aimed at our individual whims. Fred Kate says, just imagine if you were a car dealer. You could hook Aquisti's app up to your surveillance cameras, identify potential customers, and then check their incomes and credit ratings while they wandered around your lot.
These technologies only succeed in the market because people love them.
Alessandro Aquisti has no plans to sell his app or make it public. In fact, the prospect of that horrifies him. But Kate thinks the commercial pressure to use technology like this will be intense, and some of the biggest companies in America agree. PitPat was just bought by Google, but its technology only exists because of investments the government made in research in the wake of the attacks 10 years ago. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Best Buy for Business, always thinking of ways to help you get ready for business. More at bestbuyforbusiness.com. By FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a somewhat distressing sign of the Economic Times, direct from Bentonville, Arkansas. Walmart said today it's bringing back layaway payment plans. The world's biggest retailer got rid of layaways 5 years ago, that is, before the economy went south, because so many people were using credit cards to finance things. Walmart says its customers are feeling the pinch once again. They need a little help to buy what they want without going into all that credit card debt. So that's an upside, I suppose. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow dropped 118 points, just over 1%, close at 11,295 after Ben Bernanke gave that speech. The NASDAQ slipped 19 points, about 0.75%, 25.29. The number of the S&P 500 down 12 points, a little more than 1%, ended at 11.85. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune into the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow for more of the breakdown. That's our economy one step at a time. And coming up next time back on The Big Show, our week of jobs comes to a close on this question. After all the speeches and position papers and jobs plans, now what do we do? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.